It's not that this protest form, and we can talk about the particular form that became dominant in the 2010s, but it's not that the protests didn't work, period, end of story. Because in the long history of humans revolting against putting pressure upon people with power, the story of protest simply not working is an incredibly familiar one. That would be a less interesting book, a less troubling period in human history, and it would be sort of another case of what usually happens, right? What we saw instead is that the protests were incredibly powerful, that they brought far more people onto the streets than the original organizers ever planned for, than they ever expected, and they created real opportunities. The problem was, in the final analysis, who ended up taking advantage of those opportunities, because it was not the protesters themselves.
Hi, I'm Matt Ho. I'm a senior fellow with the Eisenhower Media Network, and I'm guest hosting Deep Focus this month. From 2010 to 2020, we witnessed a decade of popular uprisings which seemed to shake the foundations of the global order and threaten the elites. Across the world, protesters denounced corporate control and austerity cuts and demanded economic justice, civil rights, and self-determination. In the U.S., we saw the Occupy Wall Street protests in 2011, the Standing Rock Pipeline protests in 2016, and then the Black Lives Matter mass demonstrations in 2014, 2015, and 2020. There are also popular protests in Bahrain, Brazil, Egypt, Libya, Greece, Hong Kong, Spain, South Korea, Syria, Tunisia, Turkey, Ukraine, and Yemen. Discredited politicians were driven from office in Chile, Egypt, Greece, Spain, South Korea, Tunisia, and Ukraine. Reform and revolution dominated public discourse with the possibility of a new era. But then we saw a backlash. The aspirations of the popular movements were crushed. State control and social inequality expanded. There was little change, and in most cases, things got worse, and the far right and authoritarian governments took hold. What happened? What went wrong? How did the elites maintain or regain control? Vincent Bevins is an American journalist and author. He has been a foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, the Financial Times, and the Washington Post. Vincent's work looks at international politics, the world economy, and global culture. Vincent publishes North-South Notes on Substack, and he is the author of the seminal The Jakarta Method, Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade and the Mass Murder Program that Shaped Our World, which details the mass violence and atrocities that enabled the U.S. to win the Cold War. Vincent joins me today to talk about his most recent book, If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. Welcome to the show, Vincent.
Oh, thank you so much, and thanks for that really generous introduction.
Oh, it's. I was just saying to you before we came on, I just interviewed Bill Hartung for this program. And Bill, of course, is the co-author of The $1 trillion War Machine with Ben Freeman. And both of those books, both your book, The Jakarta Method, and this $1 trillion War Machine, are books that in the, you know, forum policy spaces, media spaces that like I'm a part of, that I take part in, that I learn from and listen to, these are books that people really talked about. These are books that people say, hey, have you read The $1 trillion War Machines? Have you read The Jakarta Method? You know, the type of book that is groundbreaking in so many ways. And maybe people understood what was occurring, but it was in a black and white, you know, didn't have the color details. And that's what you provided. You know, that's what, you know, Bill and Ben do in their book. It reminds me very much of Nick Turse's book on Vietnam and the atrocities in the Vietnam War by the American Army, Kill Anything That Moves, right? So that type of work, the importance of it, but also to how it gives confidence people to engage in this dialogue, because what they thought they understood, you affirm as being correct. So I want to begin with talking about The Jakarta Method, because it leads into, you know, this most recent book of yours, If We Burn. So can you tell me how you came to write this first book of yours, The Jakarta Method? And, you know, it wasn't because you were reading about this stuff in a library someplace, right?
No, not at all. As you said, I was for a very long time a foreign correspondent. I still do international journalism, but I worked for 6 years as a correspondent in Brazil. And then I moved to Jakarta in 2017 to serve as the correspondent for the Washington Post in Southeast Asia. Now, I got there with the intention of doing normal international journalist stuff. I wasn't looking for any particular story, but what I found in Indonesia in particular, the country I chose to live in because it's the largest country in Southeast Asia, fourth largest country in the world by population, is that no matter where you looked, this story of the untold and buried history of the 1965 massacre of leftists in Indonesia was lurking below the surface. So any story that you wanted to do, you couldn't really do without telling the story first of Indonesia's post-colonial history and the way that a left-leaning Indonesia was crushed via one of the largest mass murder programs committed against civilians in the 20th century. And so I decided to take a step back and tell that story. I decided, well, if you can't really do anything without understanding this first, why not step away from day-to-day reporting and really take the time to tell the story of not only the mass murder that occurred in Indonesia in 1965, but all of the other cases like that that either inspired it or that it inspired later in the Cold War. And as you very kindly indicated, I wasn't trying to establish that it happened. Everybody knew that. Decades of scholarship, decades of survivors speaking out, decades of careful investigation had established more or less the broad contours of the Indonesian case. What I saw my job as being was, as a journalist, someone that could spend the time to really meet all of the people that lived through this, talk to them, establish what it felt like, what happened at the human level, and make a connection between that story in Indonesia and other countries in the world that I knew fairly well because of my previous reporting experience. So I knew Spanish and I knew Portuguese. So it was about filling out that story. Well, Michael Vann, who's an academic, used a term that I liked. I'm just going to steal it. The idea was to use interviews to humanize and globalize the story. I wasn't breaking the news. I was trying to give it its human side through. And I mean, really what I did took maybe three or four times as long as it would have if I was just trying to like tell the story. It really took a long time to convince the victims of this horrific violence that I, as an American journalist from mainstream publications, was someone they should talk to or that they wanted to talk to. So that was what a lot of my work was. And I've been incredibly gratified to see that it's still kind of, well, no, it still really does exist. I get people talking to me about it in Indonesia all the time. And so I've been incredibly gratified to see that people have found that those connections useful, even though I was really just kind of adding some color here and there.
Right, right. And, you know, if you could do that, can you explain what the color is we're talking about here for people who may not be familiar with it, who haven't read the book, who are not aware of how the United States carried itself out, you know, carried itself, you know, through the Cold War, how it really acted?
Sure. I'll try to go pretty quickly. But it starts at the end of World War II, the moment in which the United States emerges from that conflict as the most powerful country in the history of humanity, by far more powerful than the Soviet Union at the time. The CIA, when founded shortly after 1945, knows how it wants to treat the communist world. It knows what it's supposed to do with the second world, as it was called at the time, the states, either the USSR itself or the states that were aligned with Moscow. And that was to wage direct subversive war. Now, the United States, having been at the time, a relatively young country compared to, say, the British Empire or many other European countries, which had a long history of colonialism, didn't really know what it was supposed to do with the third world. There was no policy clarity as to how to treat the many nations in what we would now call the global South that were not going to ally themselves very directly with the United States, but they were not in the communist camp either. Now, by the 1950s, it becomes established with the first successes of the CIA, because the CIA fails at taking on the second world. The CIA finds, well, the KGB is quite good at self-defense. They sent people into parts of the Moscow's orbit and they disappeared. But with the first successes of this young CIA in Iran and Guatemala in 1953 and 1954, respectively, of course, the 1953 case being wildly relevant to what's happened in 2026, U.S. officials thought they had they discovered two things. One, they thought they had a cheat code for changing global politics without having to put American boots on the ground as they had in Korea. Eisenhower hated the amount of Americans that went to Korea to die. And they thought, oh, wow, this is amazing. We can just do a covert coup with no consequences for the United States. Now, it took a long time to realize for them to realize that there was long-term blowback from a lot of these operations. But with Guatemala 54, which was based on Iran 53, you saw in the immediate aftermath of the establishment of a U.S.-backed anti-communist dictatorship, directives from the United States to that new regime to kill people that they thought were a threat to the new order, primarily people that were on the left. So Guatemala was a case of this. And then over in Southeast Asia, Indonesia, as I say, one of the largest countries in the world by population, emerges from its own revolutionary war with the Dutch, appearing to be acceptable to the United States because communists had been suppressed in that revolutionary movement. The new leader was certainly to the left of Eisenhower, but he was not aligning himself with the communist world. Now, throughout the 50s, it became clear in Washington, not only that they had this cheat code, and this is that other part that I think I forgot to say earlier, the policy cemented that anybody that was not with us was against us. The Third World, unless they explicitly aligned with U.S. foreign policy directives, if they allowed any kind of left to exist in their domestic political economy, could be treated as an enemy to be crushed. And in the case of Indonesia, this becomes more and more clear as a unarmed and very popular communist party begins to win more and more elections in that country. So we know now from CIA internal documentation that the agency itself believed that the Communist Party of Indonesia would have won free and fair elections had they been allowed to take place, which stopped as a result of indirectly of CIA intervention. But they tried different things. They didn't go straight for the final solution, to use a horrible but perhaps apt term. First, they tried intervention in electoral politics, copying a script that they developed in Italy to simply fund right-wing parties. That didn't work. They tried to foment a civil war. That did work. They fomented a civil war, but the CIA was caught. And so that strategy was abandoned until by 1965, military support for the Indonesian military created the conditions for the seizure of power by General Suharto, and then the extermination of approximately 1 million, certainly perhaps more. We don't have good numbers because no one has really counted. The extermination of approximately 1 million leftists or people accused of being leftists. Now, what is significant about this...
1 million, just for people to hear that again, 1 million, yeah.
Approximately 1 million, and again, this is extermination. These were not battles. This is people that are asked to come in for interviews at their local police station or are simply arrested. These are people that were in an unarmed party with absolutely no even ideology of armed struggle, let alone piles of weapons in the mountains.
Right. I think that's the point that people have to get, is the brutality that was involved in this, the coldness of it, just the extermination. As you said, in fact, you interviewed a survivor who says that when you ask them how, you know, when you ask him, how did the U.S. win the Cold War? His response was, you killed us.
Right. Yeah. And ultimately, the U.S. government at the time, if what it wanted was to flip Indonesia from the left-leaning anti-imperialist Third World into the anti-communist authoritarian capitalist camp that was firmly allied with the United States, they succeeded. And just to put one more horrible underline on that last point that you made, you couldn't kill a million people in that amount of time if it was an armed party. Hmm. You could only do it, and again, another, you know, another horrible analogy to the Holocaust carried out by Hitler. You could only do it because people believed that being in the Indonesian Communist Party was a normal, perfectly accepted. It was like you had mayors, you had teachers, you had labor. It wasn't just the left. It was people that are involved in every level of civil society. And they thought, oh, sure, I'll go down to the police station and give it. I don't know what happened. Of course, what do I have to do with what's going on back in the Capitol? And then they were never released. And so once more, this appeared to be Because we take a step back, Indonesia is more important than Vietnam in the Cold War. Way more important. Larger, more natural resources, bigger population, had much more moral heft as a result of the movement that independence leader Sukarno had created in the Third World. And so what it seemed to be to U.S. foreign policy officials is that basically overnight, with no American deaths and very minimal evidence of American involvement, even though we now know that the State Department gave lists of communists to be executed to the Indonesian military so they could cross them off and say, yes, we've done that. It seemed that a hugely important country in the Cold War was flipped from the quote unquote bad guy camp to our camp. Mm-hmm. And with very little immediate consequences for the United States. So around the world, far-right movements, allies of the CIA and the U.S. government, potential allies of the CIA and the U.S. government paid attention to this, became, and that not only was it, not only did it send shockwaves through the global left, and there are all kinds of consequences of this, because much of the global left came to the conclusion that you must be armed against the inevitable violence that will come for you. Whether or not listeners now like that conclusion, you can sort of see why people mm-hmm. came to it in 1965. Right. If people they had just been at conferences at 6-12 months ago were all literally in ditches back in Indonesia. But then the global right took a very different lesson from it. They looked at it and said, well, this is something we could do. This is something that we can do in the moment of seizing power. You just have to make sure to eliminate the opposition. Now, fast forward a little bit, just for the sake of brevity. When democratically elected socialist Salvador Allende takes over in Chile after his election, you start to get graffiti on the streets of Santiago. And the graffiti says, Yakarta viene, which is Jakarta is coming. And the message was very clear from Chile's right-wing movement. We're going, and this was a message to the left, this is a message to the government and supporters of the government. We're going to kill you, just like they killed the communists back in Indonesia. And what is tragically well known is that in 1973, Jakarta does come with the support of the CIA. Finally, Augusto Pinochet takes over as anti-communist, authoritarian, capitalist dictator of Chile, and thousands of communists are killed. Now, we could spend, there's 22 cases around the world of what you can call or was called by various different movements, some version of the Jakarta method. There was sometimes Plan Jakarta, there was sometimes the Jakarta method, sometimes it was just called Jakarta. We could go into each one of them, but the largest case after Indonesia in 1965 was in Central America in the 1980s, where hundreds of thousands of people were killed once more with U.S. guidance and support. Primarily in Guatemala and then after that in El Salvador. So as you said at the beginning, I don't think that the United States won the Cold War because this happened. We don't know what would have happened if this was unemployed. And we also know that the Cold War essentially ends because the Soviet Union just collapses. The Soviet mm-hmm. Union commits suicide on accident, I think is the way that I view it. But the world that is created by the Cold War, the relations between countries in the North and the South, are profoundly and concretely shaped by the employment of mass murder against the left, people accused of being on the left, people that are believed to be threats to U.S. economic or geopolitical interests in the 20th century. And I think that there's a lot of parts of the world, not just in Indonesia, as I learned back in 2017, where you can't understand what's happening now if you don't understand the way that the Cold War forged the particular types of nations that were built in the 20th century, because most of the countries at the UN became countries in the 20th century in this era.
Well, I think that point you just made there, Vincent, about how it took you a while, took me a while to understand this idea that we are part of a continuous line of history, and that we don't actually have our own agency, whether that be individually, socially, nationally, that we are the product of what came before us. But I would love to, gosh, we should just do the whole episode on Jakarta method, because I want to talk about my experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. I remember seeing, John Negroponte showing up in 2004 to become the ambassador for the U.S. to Iraq. Negroponte heavily involved in Central America in the 70s and 80s. involved with the death squads there. And what do we see start showing up after Negroponte shows up as ambassador to Iraq for the U.S.? The death squads in Iraq, right? And the same thing, we can say the same thing too about the counterterror campaign that the United States adopts in 2011 under General Petraeus in Afghanistan. I mean, like all this, there is this continuation. I want to go back though, because your reporting and your authorship is so poignant. And you do such a really excellent job of humanizing all this. And that's just not about telling a story, right? That's just not about providing some type of drama or you know, something other than the hardness that comes often from historical reporting, from current events reporting. You know, people kind of sneer at the human element very often. But if you don't understand the human element, if you don't understand what motivates people, you're missing the whole thing. And one of the things I want to get to, though, is this quote that you have in the Jakarta Method, because I think this ties into your next book, which we're going to talk about in a moment. And this continuation of this theme that you're so good at. And so one of the things that you write in the Jakarta Method, though, is you say, looking at it this way, the major losers of the 20th century were those who believed too sincerely in the existence of a liberal international order, those who trusted too much in democracy or too much in what the United States said it would support, rather than what it really supported, what the rich countries said rather than what they did. That group was annihilated. And, you know, as well as too, on your Substack, you just wrote a piece just a few days ago, and I want to bring this up as well too, because again, this ties into your book, If We Burn, and the connection between these two books is very clear to me. But you know, in this essay you wrote just the other day, titled "Botched Coup Part 2," you quote Hannah Arendt, and you know, Hannah Arendt wrote in 1970, "Power and violence are opposites. Where the one rules absolutely, the other is absent. Violence appears where power is in jeopardy, but left to its own course, it ends in power's disappearance." So, you know, with that, how does what you're writing about how the American empire, right, acted throughout the Cold War, how it annihilated a whole class of people around the world that believed in the liberal international order, how does that then provide the foundation for what you write about these mass movements, you know, throughout the world from 2010 to 2020?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting that question. And reinterpreting the significance of the Jakarta Method in terms of that quote, I think is really helpful to understand what the point was. Because as I said, in Indonesia, the go-to play was not mass murder. The employment of violence is not the point. The point is the establishment of the quiet order afterwards, in which everyone in Indonesia knows you cannot talk about what happened. There is no such thing as the left anymore. If you indicate you're on the left, you're in big trouble. And that there can be the orderly accumulation of capital, and General Suharto can rule with U.S. support. That's the point. The violence is about getting that done. They stopped the violence basically when it became clear that that was established. Now, to use the end of Arendt's quote, if they had killed every single person in Indonesia, well, then that's no use to empire. Mm-hmm. Who's gonna extract the resources? Right. Whose labor are we gonna extract? Right. What's the point of having Indonesia in our camp if we've absolutely annihilated it, right? And so the Cold War ends, as I say, I think, accidentally. Gorbachev doesn't know what he's doing, and I think the U.S. doesn't know what he's doing until it becomes clear to everyone. And you get a couple of decades, which I think were not really incorrectly called. I mean, I think it's interesting and sort of correct, as well as a little bit funny, to call it the end of history, because it's an era that's now ended. So there was an era in which it seemed as if there was only one way forward for humanity, which was the liberal capitalist solution to all of the great debates of the 20th century. But you also had in that period the formal democratization of a lot of the anti-communist authoritarian regimes that existed in the 20th century. So across Latin America, you get social revolutions from below overthrowing the old regimes, it becomes less important for the United States to back them in this new era because the perceived threat of the Soviet Union is gone. But I think it's correct to recognize now that that formal democratization that we saw in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s across the global South did not change the underlying structures that the movements of the 50s, 60s, 40s, 70s wanted to change in the first place. You had the kind of a democratization that was possible in the neoliberal era. And the neoliberal era, of course, has consequences in the global North as well. You have widening income inequality. You have people believing, for example, in Spain, in New York, in Greece, people believing increasingly throughout the neoliberal era that elites do not represent them. And also political scientists, not just, you know, radicals and revolutionaries, coming to the conclusion through careful empirical study that elites don't represent regular people anymore, that elites represent regular people when their interests align with economic elites. And so you see, and this is where we get to where my second book opens. After the financial crisis of 2008, you begin to see a wave of revolts around the world. And so the people that are able to count these things, I'm not sure exactly how you count these things, but the people who do their best to count these things came to the conclusion that the 2010s had more people participate in mass protests than in any other point in human history, breaking the record previously established by the famous thought of contention in the 1960s, right? So those of us who grew up in the end of the 20th century will remember that the 60s was like the protest decade, right? Well, the 2010s beat it, at least in terms of sheer numbers. And I think in a lot of ways, it was the beginning of a global attempt to slowly reconstruct the type of movements and the type of activities and the type of actions that could serve as pressure from below to either change what elites were doing or to become the new elites themselves. Now, you already hinted at the sort of the ending, and everybody knows by now, you know, everybody, you know, we don't have a liberal.
Right. We're living it. We're living it.
Yeah. We don't have a liberal democratic Egypt controlling the border of Israel. You know, we don't have, Ukraine's, still enmeshed in this horrifying war. What I decided to do in this book, because this draws more on my experiences that I had in my first major job as a correspondent in Brazil before I moved to Indonesia, was to tell the story of the 2010s as if the most important thing to happen in that decade is the mass protest, as if the most important thing to happen in that decade is the protest that it gets so big that it becomes something else. And so I wove together all the stories and I didn't have to do the weaving myself. They were already woven, right? Because Occupy Wall Street was inspired by Tahrir Square in Egypt, which was inspired by Tunisia, and all of these three inspired later Hong Kong 24. You know, the weaving was not a creative act. It was just a retracing of the connections in the real world. I tried to tell the story of the 2010s with the cases at its center that either overthrew governments or fundamentally destabilized existing governments and forced some kind of change. Now, in the vast majority of cases, if you ask the participants themselves, the original organizers of the people that put together the protests in the first place, and that's what I did. I ran around the world doing this for several years. In the majority of cases, people will tell you things got worse. That things.
Right. I think you say out of 10 cases, 7 failed, or not failed, but things got worse. Right. So 7
things
out
got
of 10.
Worse. Yeah. And again, that it's important that by whose standard? And the standard is that which is articulated initially by the protests themselves. Like according to the standards articulated by, because you know, if you're on the right, then a country going to the right is great, but if a protest is pushing for more social services and then at the end the country has less, then that's going backwards. So what I found is that it's not that this protest form, and we can talk about the particular form that became dominant in the 2010s, but it's not that the protests didn't work, period, end of story. Because in the long history of humans revolting against putting pressure upon people with power, The story of protests simply not working is an incredibly familiar one. That would be a less interesting book, a less troubling period in human history, and it would be sort of another case of what usually happens, right? What we saw instead is that the protests were incredibly powerful, that they brought far more people onto the streets than the original organizers ever planned for, than they ever expected, and they created real opportunities. The problem was, in the final analysis, who ended up taking advantage of those opportunities, because it was not the protesters themselves.
And you have one of the things that's great about this book is that you draw these lessons out, right? And so certainly it could just be a story of how things got worse or it didn't work out, right? Or and you throw your hands up in the air. But what you've done is critiqued it. And you've given, I think, for those of us who've taken part in these things that we identify as things that we agree with. You know, I was at Standing Rock, right? I took part in the Black Lives Matter protests. I've taken part in protests in three different continents, right? And so a lot of what you critique here about how these resistance movements, these protest movements were not organized to take on power, not organized to take on structure. So whether that was your criticisms of horizontal leadership, your criticism of the lack of preparation to fill the gap when there is a vacuum, who steps in, who's best prepared for that. This idea that one of the things I used to drives me nuts still, this idea that all actions have equal value, simply not true, or that we're gonna embrace our principles at the expense of strategy, right? So that we're going to do things that are counter to what we're trying to achieve because these are our principles and we don't care how it plays out on local news to the people we're trying to win over, right? I mean, so all these various examples you have there, as well as the two, you've got a really good point in the book about digital spaces versus physical spaces. So I know I just threw a whole bunch of things out there, but you know, if you want to extrapolate on any of that or get into kind of some of why how come it didn't work? You know, how come you had all these people out there, we had social media. I was watching what was happening in Tahrir Square from my house, right? You know, et cetera. What happened? Well, why didn't it work?
Yeah. Well, again, like sort of the weird thing is it kind of did until something else had to be done.
Okay. Yeah.
And you pointed to, and I know that we agree on that, and you pointed earlier to something before I start the full explanation. This isn't my language, but you were saying, well, like an action must be taken. It doesn't matter what. Somebody once called this do something-ism. Like we have to do something. Like it doesn't matter what the outcome is going to be, but certainly something must be done. And if the only thing that can be done is going to make things worse for everyone involved, well, something must be done. Well, anyways, so what we saw in the 2010s, okay, let's go back even further. In the 20th century, there were a standard and reliable set of practices or organizational forms that might be relied upon to put pressure on the state or to try to create a new state, right? So there were social movements. There was the organized civil rights movements of the type that we have in the 1960s, often very tightly organized, very disciplined, with clear representation. You had unions. You had mass political parties. You had civil society organizations, and then in more extreme cases, this is not as relevant in the liberal democratic world, but you had even organized revolutionary parties or guerrilla movements that were prepared or trying to seize the state and create a new one. Now, what happens is we get to the end of the 20th century and everybody sort of agrees on this, that it's an empirical fact. They disagree on the reasons, but as we enter the neoliberal age, there's just less people in organizations. There's less people in unions. There's less people in political parties. There's less people in social movements. And I think it becomes clear if we think about what life is like now. It's just work. We are atomized and we're disconnected from each other. We're precarious. And just empirically, sociologically, it's harder to organize people into the kinds of discrete, easily identifiable groups that were so characteristic of 20th century, even 19th century struggles. I think the neoliberal era has a lot to do with this. I think that a more difficult economic environment has a lot to do with this. When you're precarious and you're living as an individual rather than working in a factory and a union member, these are all, there's a lot of reasons, but organization became more difficult and people were more atomized. So as we saw, the first responses to the consequences of the 2008 financial crisis, there was ideological explanations for the response that was the easiest to put together given material conditions. So I'm about to, I know it's, maybe I'm all over the place here, but a particular type of response became hegemonic in the 2010s, and there was both material and ideological reasons for that. And that repertoire, and those that lived through it will remember this, you know, that sort of recipe of what could be done to contest power or to put pressure was the apparently spontaneous, leaderless, digitally coordinated, so advertised on social media, people are brought together on social media, horizontally structured, meaning everyone's at the same level, no one's above anybody else, no one can tell anyone what to do. Mass protest, rather than, not a strike, not a boycott, not an organized political movement, a protest in public spaces or public squares. Now that repertoire comes together, and as I say, it was possible, it was the easiest thing to do, and there were some ideological elements on the anti-authoritarian left that were, you know, most, it's not that everybody in the world in 2009 was like a horizontalist anarcho-utopian leftist, but there were some elements out there that when this thing came together, they were like, oh yeah, this is justified, this is a great way to organize things. And those ideological justifications, if you look at where they came from, they make sense too. Some of it has to do, they make sense. It's easy to understand how parts of the left, and especially the rich world in the 1960s and 70s, became disillusioned with the consequences of older revolutionary movements that fell apart on their own, or there were critiques of the Soviet Union, which translated into a kind of wholesale rejection of what, of everything that led to it. So let's do this, do the exact opposite of the party. Let's do the exact opposite of the union. Anyways, this form that we have in the 2010s, the apparently spontaneous protest of individuals coming together very, very quickly without any pre-existing organizational links, is incredibly effective at mobilizing people in huge numbers. So as I, you know, this is, comes over and over and over, and on North South Notes, this little publication I've launched on Substack, maybe by the time this is out, but I'm editing it right now, some Kenyans have written about this again happening in 2024, and we're publishing the recollections on what have now been called the Gen Z protests in Kenya. But over and over and over, what you hear is, you know, I spent years trying to organize a protest and not that many people came. And then this time, just 1,000 times as many people as I expected came. Now what this does, this particular form of protest that grows immensely in a short period of time, in the cases that I analyze, either in the extreme, sends the government packing. So like literally the dictator has to get on a plane and flee the country, right? Or in less extreme cases, the government understands that things cannot continue as usual and some kind of concessions need to be made. Now, in the more extreme example, there's no government. The president's fled. A digitally coordinated, horizontally structured mass of individuals standing in the square cannot become the new government, or at least not, they can't become the government right away, right? You could, you know, in some parts of the, you know, anarchist or anti-authoritarian left, there's like theories that this could happen over time. But in every concrete case, what happened is you had a power vacuum, means somebody else wanted to seize power. And that might have been the local military. It might have been an imperialist counterattack launched by one of your neighbors, or it might have been some other organized group in domestic civil society. There was no case in which it was actually the protesters that entered the power vacuum. So the cases in which the opportunities
and in created, these cases, just to you know, because you could look at, say, the revolution in 79 in Iran, which was broad based, right? And then who comes out on top? It's the reaction religious side of that movement, because they were the best prepared, they were the best resourced, right? They came out on top. But there, it's still in support of the revolution. What you're talking about here, though, is that those who come out on top, or if you were, who fill the vacuum, aren't part of that reform. They're not part of that revolution. They are, you know, right. That's what you're saying, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And for better or worse, sociologists point to either Nicaragua or 79 Iran as like the last revolution of the classic type in which an entirely new group does enter power. And then there is some kind of a social reconstruction. What you see in the 2010s, and we could talk about individual cases or, you know.
I mean, I got to stop you there because I had not heard that before. And now I'm racking my brain to try and come up with like a counter example. And right. That's depressing, man.
Yeah. So what you've seen since, and Mark Beisinger calls them, I think, civic revolutions. I think that a lot of other people would say you can't really use the word revolution if what you're having is basically a game of musical chairs played by the elites, right? So you have, let's think of a historical analogy. Che Guevara, Fidel Castro wage a guerrilla war in the mountains of Cuba until they forced the Batista government to flee and exit power. Now, if Che and Fidel were unwilling or unable to take power, if they just said, okay, we're done, what would have happened? My guess, and this is based on what I saw in the 2010s, my guess is that probably remnants of the old Batista government would get in contact with the United States, get in contact with the military, and put together something that was kind of the same, but with a different name.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happens eventually in Egypt. In 2011, there is a real power vacuum, and the military enters it. And the military says, oh, we're going to hold new elections. And they do. And so the Muslim Brotherhood wins, and people don't like that much. And new protests are used as an excuse to just have a coup and then install a new military dictatorship, which many people say is worse than the one that was originally thrown over in 2011. Now, in a country like Bahrain, it's a foreign power that takes advantage. It's Saudi Arabia, with the backing of the United States, just marches over the bridge and crushes the uprising in Bahrain and reinforces the existing power structure and says, you know, we're going to get away with it. We're just going to repress. So, and then in the cases in which the protest led to something that was experienced as something like a moderate victory or some kind of success, the group that took advantage of the opportunities were somehow or another allies of the protesters. They at least understood where they were coming from. They at least shared some of their goals. Chile in 2019 with Gabriel Boric eventually taking power is one example of this. That all falls apart years later. But at the moment, it seems like at least an ally has taken power. But it's still not the protesters. It's still the protesters on the streets that say, wait a minute, someone is seizing this. Someone is stealing our lunch. And it's, you know, that's kind of glib, because really what has happened is that real political possibilities have been forged through struggle and death and bravery and collective action. But then once that power vacuum is created, they watch in horror as somebody else fills it. And then in the other less extreme case, where the government doesn't flee, but they understand that something needs to be done, well-intentioned or not, and I think some of the governments were well-intentioned, they tried to set up some sort of means of coordinating with the movement, like in the way that in the United States in the 1960s, you could call in SNCC and CORE and Martin Luther King to ask, well, what does the civil rights movement want, and what can we give you so that you'll sort of stand in a photo next to me and shake my hand and say that, you know, you're happy that we did this. They couldn't put together the negotiating group, right? Like, they would try. They would grab some people, and then at the same time.
Well, the other side, not to interrupt, it's because I'm always stuck with the example of this from the Occupy movement, was that then the media, because you're talking about who's going to negotiate, but also too, you have this other component, public information, right? Propaganda, communication, whatever you want to call it. Well, if you don't have your persons presented, the media or whoever it is going to pick who they want to represent you. Right. And I mean, I can think of this example, whether listening to people being interviewed on NPR, who I just know every truck driver who may have been in agreement with Occupy, after they heard that conversation on the radio, they were no longer in agreement with Occupy just because of the way things were phrased, things were said. Or I can think about too, Stephen Colbert having people from Occupy on, and they just were, they were buffoons. And he treated them that way. And he used them that way as almost like circus, as almost like a circus act, right? I mean, so this is so important what you're talking about here in terms of, you know, leadership, right?
Because you couldn't use Martin Luther King as a buffoon.
No.
Right?
Right.
Yes,
right.
There was no way you could do that. And if you tried to, and you know, were there some people marching behind Martin Luther King in those thousands and thousands of half of millions of people that supported the civil rights movement that would say stupid stuff on camera? Obviously.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Most humans aren't trained for that kind of an encounter. It's hard to come off well in a TV show.
But isn't there also, too, a need for these movements to have leaders for the movement's sake themselves? Don't people want to be led?
So what happens, we've seen this historically, and a lot of really foundational texts came out of the experimental movements in the 60s and 70s that tried to be leaderless, is that if a group is big enough, some kind of structure will be imposed upon it. Now, so the question is not between are we leaderless or do we have leaders? The question is, are we going to democratically choose our own structure, or is it going to be chosen by somebody else? And you've pointed to that one of the dynamics by which through which the structure is chosen by somebody else. In Egypt, the people that organized the protest that became 2011 in Tahrir Square had spent better part of a decade organizing together, largely in support of Palestine, but around other causes as well. But they always believed that democracy in Egypt would necessarily and fundamentally challenge U.S. interests in the region. They believed that a democratic Egypt would oppose Israel's actions and contest Saudi Arabia as a regional power, right? So they always believed that truly democratic Egypt would contest U.S. sub-imperial structures with some, you know, some kind of language like this. As a matter of course, just because if you poll people in Egypt, 95% of people want to cut off ties with Israel, something like this. So they always believed, okay, democracy equals challenging U.S. intervention in the Arab world. Then you got, during Tahrir Square, CNN showing up. And again, I don't know if this is cynical or not, but they go in the square and they grab the liberal that will say, that will reinforce the narrative that they're presenting, which is that Egypt wants to join the free world, which means that it just wants to be a junior partner of America in the global order. And this was experienced, I mean, this is experienced as profoundly psychological difficult. Like just watching this happen, like I've spoken, you know, people who had a very hard time dealing with this for years, that this happened to them. And it wasn't that they had chosen, oh, we don't want leaders. It's just that Egyptian civil society had been crushed in a way that there was just no way to put together the types of organizations that would have been well-structured. I don't think the question of leadership is the key one, because you can have collective leadership, you can have rotating leadership, but you need to have some representation of the movement to the world, to the state. And if that representation is not chosen democratically by the movement itself, it will be chosen by someone else. And sometimes the government just cherry picks who they want to talk to. Sometimes the people that go viral on social media become the de facto leaders. Sometimes the mainstream media picks those leaders. And so this is one of the many dynamics that emerge after that initial phase when, oh, now we've really done something. This is a big thing now. Mm-hmm. And new direction is required. And we don't have the means to decide amongst ourselves what that will be. And to the extent that a small group of people might be needing to speak on behalf of the group, there's no way we can decide who those people are and hold them. Again, go back to like a union or a political party. The union leader, yeah, he is the leader, but he has to be responsible to the member. He doesn't just get to go out there and say whatever he wants, right?
Right.
Like
right.
If he just starts making stuff or going wild, he gets recalled. None of those kinds of mechanisms existed. And so over and over and over, someone else takes advantages of the opportunities. In most of the cases, this is the enemies of the original organizers. In many cases, you see right-wing populism being able or willing to seize power in ways that left-leaning populist movements could not or did not want to. I mean, you can sort of tell the story of the 2010s in which you have the left raises very serious critiques of the existing order, but does not carry through with providing answers in the form of new government. And then the right very cynically pretends to answer those same questions, pretends to offer solutions in the form of themselves. Just say, okay, sure. Well, you know, everyone knows there's something wrong. Well, the solution's me and also, hey, immigrants.
Right. Hey, nature abhors a vacuum, right? Something's going to fill that vacuum. And also, too, I think what you're saying here, Vincent, you know, it's your articulation of it in a sense of the modern context is, you know, so important. And one of the things you just, I'll just say in terms of, but some of those we've seen before, I mean, it was a Ben Franklin who said, a democracy, if you can keep it. You know, I think that was Ben Franklin, right? I mean, so this idea of, hey, you've gotten to this point, but are you prepared to do what's next? Are you prepared to now fill the roles that you have created by your actions? You know, I also think it's important to point out this notion about horizontal leadership, which you pointed out here, this idea that horizontal leadership was created by the crushing of civic groups, right? The crushing of opposition. How can you create it? How can you have a leadership if that leadership is going to get scooped up by the secret police? But we only have a few minutes left, and I know we're over time here with you, and you've been so generous. This is so great. But the book, If We Burn, ends in 2020, and now it's 2026. And so if you just want to, have you seen changes in the last 6 years, or like, you know, the big Indian farmer protests, the European farmers that were stopping traffic all throughout Europe a couple of years ago, even the Women, Life and Freedom movement in Iran a few years back? Are you seeing things noticeably different in how these movements are acting now as compared to what you document in your book, If We Burn?
Yes and no. And speaking of Iran, it was really interesting. 3 weeks ago, so before the MOU, before Trump changes his mind, I get a text from my translator in Iran. He says, oh, we just published If We Burn. It just came out. I was like, oh, I thought you guys would have been like really busy. He's like, yeah, it's, you know, life stuff. But, you know, we just put it out this week. So it came out in the middle of the war. And a lot of women life.
Hey, I think that needs to be a blurb on the next edition that comes out. They even published this book is so good. They published it during a war.
Yeah.
And women, life, freedom was a big part of the Iranians that wanted to have, a lot of Iranians that participated in the women, life, freedom wanted to have conversations with me either privately or publicly about the book as well. So I wrote this in the afterword to the paperback edition. I've seen since 2020, whether we're talking about pro-Palestine encampments in the US or the quote unquote Gen Z protests that erupt in Kenya, Indonesia, Madagascar, I've seen that ideologically there has been a lot of evolution since the 2010s. Ideologically, people are less likely to believe, as many people did in 2011, that spontaneity and structurelessness and leaderlessness were good things in and of themselves. There's less of a belief that the more leaderless, the better, the more spontaneous, the better. So there's been some ideological change. People are more likely to want to build something like a union or a party or a revolutionary movement, or the kind of capacity for collective action that can take advantage of an opportunity. But material conditions are the same or perhaps worse. So it is still incredibly difficult to create those movements. It is still incredibly difficult to do anything but the apparently spontaneous mass protests of individuals in the square. So I think I've seen less people, less insistent that this is the best way to do things and the only way to do things, but you still see it happening for understandable reasons, which is that in the context of Kenya in 2024, what you have is concretely a lot of people that are precarious and unemployed and not connected except for the moment that they all respond to the same horrific images on social media. And so on the other hand, if you look at, there's many hands now, so that was the two elements. But also what happens, and this happens historically in protests, ones that succeed and ones that fail and ones that go nowhere, is that in the movements, people try to come together in new ways. I mean, DSA in the United States, you can draw a line where 2011, a lot of people participate in Occupy Wall Street. They realize they really made a point, but that having a permanent assembly in an occupation of a particular park wasn't going to change the state, and then people come together and do new things and get into organizing in the labor movement or organizing new political movements. And ultimately you're seeing, you know, many, many years later, the effects of that kind of attempt. So you're seeing, I do still think in the 2020s, the easiest thing to do is the mass protest, the uncoordinated and apparently spontaneous mass protest. But you do see a big change in the desire to build something with the capacity for long-term structural transformation. That's what matters. Long-term is what matters. In 2100, when they write the history of these movements, whether or not they were successes or failures is not going to be about what it felt like the day after. It's about how they change society in the long term, whether or not we build a freer and more democratic and more humane society in the long term or not. And that depends on what we do between now and 2100.
Right. Hey, that's a really excellent, excellent point to leave this on. And Vincent, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you all for watching. This has been a Deep Focus where I'm guest hosting for the month. Our guest today, again, was Vincent Bevins, journalist and author of If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. You can follow and support Vincent's work on the North South Notes Substack. Please like, share, and comment on this episode for Deep Focus, where we bring you deep discussions on topics of the day. Thank you.
Thank you.